You don't need to be ripped. You just need the right shirt. Epic Fits gives you a clean, confident silhouette. Snug on the arms, soft on the skin, generous where it counts. And with deals like $15 per tee, they won't break the bank. Visit epicfits.com today. Epic Fits. T-shirts that get it.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia, and dedicated to the proposition articulated by Walter Lippmann during World War II that a strong and balanced foreign policy is a necessary shield of our democratic republic. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, a non-resident fellow at the Miller Center and a Bulwark contributor, and I'm joined, as I frequently am in this enterprise, by my colleague, Elliot Cohen, the Professor Emeritus of Strategy at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and the Arleigh Burke Chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. Elliot, great to be back with you after the holiday.
Yeah, it's great to be back with you. I notice we both have gotten a little bit of sun. That's a good thing. Let me begin by first saying it's interesting feeling having hung up my spurs after 34 years at Johns Hopkins. One of the things that I did towards the end as dean that I was proudest of was our helping to oversee our recruitment of our guest. And that is Dr. Sergei Rodchenko, who's the Wilson E. Schmidt Distinguished Professor at Johns Hopkins SAIS. He's based in our Bologna campus, but he flits back and forth. He's part of our Kissinger Center. He has written a large but fascinating book, To Run the World, The Kremlin's Cold War Bid for Global Power. Really a fascinating account of the Cold War from the Russian point of view. Sergei has a really interesting, unusual background. So if I might, I think rather than me run through the biography, Sergei, first, welcome. And secondly, could you just tell us a little bit about your life story? Because it's very much, I think, connected with what makes the book unusual and valuable.
Well, thank you, Elliot, and thank you, Eric, for hosting me on the podcast. I am indeed recently recruited by SAIS. I like to tell the story of a move from Sakhalin to SAIS. Of course, Sakhalin being the place where I grew up back in the 1980s, 1990s. And it's certainly not a very likely place from where people go on to become professors at SAIS, I can tell you that. So it is a bit of a strange story, but I benefited greatly actually from the end of the Cold War, and in particular from the program sponsored by the United States government. It was called Freedom Support Act. Actually, the person behind it was Senator Bill Bradley, who was pushing this forward. The idea was to bring youngsters from all over the former USSR to sort of experience America. And so in 1995, I left the wilderness of the Russian Far East, where I was growing up as a teenager, and went to Texas and spent a few years there, and then just sort of bounced around the world with part of my time spent in China, in Mongolia, where I got married, lived in the UK. And of course, finally, I came to SAIS, very happy to be here. And I'm certainly very happy to be speaking today to the two of you about this book, which in some ways does connect to my personal experience, because of course, I did benefit from the end of the Cold War. And it's fascinating for me to go back to the Cold War and to see what lessons can be drawn for the present.
Yeah, you are sort of living proof that there is something to the idea of soft power.
That's right.
That was a very, very good program. Could you say something? I mean, one way the book's very straightforward. It's the full sweep of the Cold War. Say something about the archival work that went into this, because I think one of the distinguishing features of it, one of the things that makes it so particularly interesting, is the access that you've been able to get to a variety of archives. So could you just walk us through that, and then we can begin talking about more substantive things?
So this is actually something counterintuitive. You would think that Putin's regime that has become increasingly repressive would not release archival materials. But in fact, there has been something of just an overflow, really. There's an absolute flood of archival materials that have been released since approximately 2013-2014 that detail almost, well, every aspect of Soviet foreign policy. When I first saw those materials working in the archives in Moscow, I mean, I was absolutely perplexed. And I was obviously gladdened by this wealth of documentation, which allowed us to retell and still allows us to retell every aspect of the Cold War with new evidence. And some of that reinforces existing historiography, and some of that actually overturns some of the existing perceptions. But fundamentally, what it allows us to do is to go close and personal with the Soviet leaders, because we have just thousands and thousands of pages of their conversations, of their speeches, of their memoranda, of their rants, literally rants, like in the case of Nikita Khrushchev, who liked to rant, and he would be, all of his rants would be taken down by, you know, stenographers. So we have a collection of Nikita Khrushchev's rants, which are actually remarkable for understanding his thinking about the Cold War and about the Soviet Union's place in the international order. But that is part of the story. Another part of the story is that I was very fortunate. I lived in China for about 4 years prior to moving to SAIS. It was back just when Xi Jinping became the leader of China. And at that time, under late Hu Jintao and early Xi Jinping, there was actually remarkable openness with regard to the Chinese archives, and that was able to access a tremendous amount of materials from the Chinese archives that are no longer accessible. Even then, of course, it was difficult to access them, but I was able to get the stuff, which also allowed me to retell the story of the Cold War from the Chinese angle, bringing in wealth of new materials. So all of that is great. It's a great basis for writing history of the Cold War. Sadly, a lot of this material is no longer available, or it was never available, like in China's case, it was very difficult to get. But in Russia's case, although it's there, I do not encourage anybody to go there to try to get it, including myself, because at this point, it's getting too, you know, it's becoming too dangerous. And I no longer travel to Russia ever since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, because I feel it's just too dangerous and there's a high risk of being arrested.
You know, I mean, multi-archival research, that's the gold standard in diplomatic history. Let me ask just one question and then hand it over to Eric. What would you say, you know, if you had to list, I don't know, somewhere between 3 and 6 kind of key findings or, you know, reassessments of things that we thought we knew that you think are really distinctive about this book?
So there are more than 3 or 6. There are lots of places like that. And that's the fun thing about the book, because you find this remarkable pieces of evidence that tell us something new about, like, for example, the Cuban Missile Crisis, such a key moment of the Cold War. Every little piece of evidence matters. And here we have Khrushchev ranting about how he perceives Kennedy. I mean, what we come to understand from this is, of course, Khrushchev was even more terrified of the prospects of a nuclear war than what we previously believed possible. And it comes through very clearly in his communications, his letters to Castro, for example, that are now available. There are bits and pieces of evidence which I found remarkable on the Korean War, which, for example, shows why Stalin finally agreed to Kim Il-sung's invasion of South Korea. I mean, we've long suspected that this was because he thought that the Americans would not intervene in Korea. But now we have this document that shows that basically the Soviets intercepted American intelligence that suggested that they would not intervene. So there are bits and pieces of evidence that really fill in the gaps in our understanding of some of the key moments. And there are also interesting materials that really show why multi-archival work is great for historians. For example, we have records of conversations between Richard Nixon and the Soviet leader Brezhnev, which do not exist in the American archives. They only exist in the Russian archives. So they tell you this a different story. And the reason they don't exist in the American archives is that Henry Kissinger was taking the notes in some of those meetings, and Brezhnev did not want to raise the key issues while Kissinger was there. In particular, he didn't want to talk about the Middle East, because he thought that Kissinger was partial towards Israel. So he was waiting to get Kissinger out of the door and then talk to Nixon. And so this stuff exists in Moscow, but it doesn't exist in the American record. And by juxtaposing those two things, you really arrive at a better understanding of fundamentally what actually happened.
Yeah, I suspect that there'll be something similar in, you know, 30 or 40 years time when people are going back to look at the records of the Hamburg and Helsinki summit conversations between then President Trump and possibly future President Trump and Vladimir Putin, where only the Russian notes, at least as far as we can tell, seem to exist.
Well, they're not necessarily the most reliable. I mean, in the end, you have to juxtapose the two sets of notes, because presumably the Russians would also want to hide something. And you can see, for example, during the percentages agreement between the British and the Soviets, that, you know, the British memorandum of conversation says one thing, the Russians says another thing. Churchill remembered something else entirely in his memoirs. So you put all those pieces together, you triangulate them, and you try to figure out, well, why are there contradictions? And can we actually tell history, or tell some kind of history on the basis of this? This is what I tried to do in the book.
Yeah, as a trained diplomatic historian, I have to say I enjoyed the book. You know, not just that I read it, you know, we've got a guest, I have to read it. I really did savor reading it. You know, at the beginning of the book, you talk about coming across the files of former Foreign Minister Litvinov and former ambassador to Britain, Ivan Maisky. And these were the equivalents of what I, as a graduate student, was fooling around with, which was the Harley Nodder file, which was the file in the American records, as you know, Record Group 59, the State Department records of post-war planning by the State Department during World War II. And you actually go into, in some detail, some of this Russian post-war planning and how it ended up not necessarily, you know, completely conforming to the facts that they discovered after the war. I wonder if you could talk, one of the themes and one of the things I found fascinating about the book was your effort to disentangle the degree to which Marxist-Leninist ideology and realpolitik were involved in the motivation of Soviet policy. And correct me if I'm wrong, you seem to come down as saying that more often than not, ideology was a kind of post facto rationalization for policy as opposed to an actual motive force. And the motive forces tended to be driven more by realpolitik concerns. But having said that, I consistently found in your own book evidence of instances where, whether it was Stalin or Khrushchev or Mao, were interpreting international events clearly through a very strong ideological lens. So I wonder if you could help disentangle some of those things as you went through and wrote the book.
So this is, Eric, this is a great question. And I think part of the problem that we have as scholars talking about the role of realpolitik versus ideology is that we're not clear sometimes about the terminology, what actually, you know, words like ideology are supposed to mean. So, you know, somebody will say, oh, you know, ideology was hugely important. Somebody will say, no, ideology actually didn't really matter. But in reality, when you draw, you know, when you discuss this closely, it turns out that they have very different conceptions of what ideology was supposed to be. So when I question ideology and the role of ideology in Soviet foreign policy, I question formal ideology more than anything else, i.e. the Marxist-Leninist canon. And I say that a lot of the times this basically just covered up other interests, or it was used instrumentally to advance particular policies. But if you adopt a broader notion of the word or the broader idea of ideology, excuse my tautology here, i.e. a view of the world, not necessarily connected to, let's say, the Marxist-Leninist canon, but broadly speaking, a view of the world, then I think, yes, of course, how can it not be relevant? Of course, it matters how we view the world. But the problem is that when you talk about Soviet ideology in a broader sense, then there are other factors that can contribute to it and that sometimes play a defining role in it. So in my book, I talk about the role of race, or plainly speaking, racism. So in the way that, for example, Soviet leaders like Brezhnev envisioned the world, they saw the Chinese as being, you know, very, very basically, you know, hideous, untrustworthy, inferior to them in various ways. You know, in the way they talk about it, it's kind of really racial or civilizational. And Brezhnev perceived himself as a European. He always contrasted the Soviet Union to China, saying, well, you know, those Chinese, they cannot be trusted because they're not European. I am a European. How does it work from a Marxist-Leninist perspective? It doesn't. Those two things do not connect. And yet they're part of Brezhnev's vision. They're part of his broader, you know, broadly speaking, ideology, if you talk about ideology as a worldview. I think that is where the tension becomes particularly evident. But so the way I talked about it in the book is I basically went beyond this question of, you know, ideology, or maybe it's something else. And I said, well, actually, you know, fundamentally what the Soviets wanted was that they wanted legitimacy. They wanted their place in the international order to be recognized. They aspire to greatness, and this greatness, they felt some of that, most of it actually came from external recognition, not random recognition by countries that did not matter, so to speak, from their perspective, but recognition by the United States. They themselves saw the Americans as the ultimate recognizer, because they saw America as the great superpower out there. If America only recognized Soviet legitimacy, Soviet quote-unquote legitimate interests, and Soviet greatness, then this would make them legitimate and great. So that desire for recognition, for legitimacy, drove Soviet foreign policy from Stalin through to Khrushchev to Brezhnev all the way through the end of the Cold War. And here's an interesting thing. I don't see 1989 as a blip, but I certainly go beyond 1989. And there's a long conclusion that connects the Cold War to the post-Cold War, which is actually very interesting because, of course, if I was writing this book 10, 15 years ago, you know, people would think, well, the Cold War is something in the past. It's history. We're no longer talking about this. Or if we talk about it, it's something like, you know, something ancient. Whereas now we are realizing that the Cold War has something that is in common with our own experience today. And indeed, some people are starting to talk about our own times as a continuation of the Cold War. And if you look at my book, you can see how some themes, the striving for recognition, the striving for legitimacy, for greatness, how that was actually part of both Soviet foreign policy, but also post-Soviet foreign policy, and how we therefore can connect the Cold War to our own times.
I'd like to come back to that last point later in the conversation to get at the question of how Putin fits into this tradition of striving, as you say, for legitimacy, equality with the United States, and greatness. But I just wanted to kind of highlight a couple of points in the book where where ideology does sort of raise its head in the sense of, as you were just saying, kind of how leaders interpret the world. Because I mean, I think Elliot and I both have this experience of having been in government and having, seen in real life, you know, Carl Becker's old adage that every man is his own historian, right? And all policymakers have some conception of history in their head, whether it was a good one or a bad one. But in the book, I mean, there's some fascinating places where you talk, for instance, about Stalin at the London and Moscow foreign ministers conferences in September and December of 1945, being taken aback that inter-imperialist rivalries, which she thought would completely drive apart the United States and the United Kingdom, didn't seem to be, in fact, you know, happening. You know, you talk about Khrushchev seeing Jack Kennedy as a tool of monopoly capital, even as he was actually fighting the business community over steel prices in the United States. So there seems to be this misprision of what's going on that leads to some big, you know, big mistakes that you outline in the book. And I just wonder if you can sort of, you know, decouple that from the policy side.
Well, so it becomes extremely difficult. And Stalin actually is a very interesting example. So we can say that Stalin believed in the inevitability of war, right? This is a well-known concept. Stalin believed in the inevitability of war. That changed under Khrushchev because Khrushchev recognized the power of nuclear weapons, and by the mid-1950s, we're moving away from this idea of inevitability of war. But under Stalin, we have this inevitability of war thesis, which if you're coming at it from a Marxist-Leninist perspective, you might say, you know, Stalin believed in the inevitability of war because this is what Marxism-Leninism says. Basically, imperialist powers will go after one another. They go, you know, there's competition for markets, and war therefore becomes inevitable. Or you could actually come around from a different angle, and you can say that Stalin believed in the inevitability of war because he just had such a dark mind, a very Machiavellian mind. He believed in struggle, etc., that actually, you know, this concept has, it's not even necessarily related to anything that Marx said. It predates Marx. It goes back to, you know, to Sparta in Athens. The strong exact what they can and the weak grant what they must. So in other words, you've got these two different approaches to explaining Stalin. And as historians, we would actually struggle to say what particular framework he adopted at any particular moment and how a realism emerged in his mind with Marxism-Leninism, how they potentially reinforced one another. How do you reconcile this? And I found this actually the same problem with every other Soviet leader. So, of course, some of this rhetoric of Marxism-Leninism that you refer to, like, you know, Khrushchev talking about Kennedy being a plaything of the capitalists, et cetera, yeah, that creeps into the conversation. And as a historian, of course, I have to show this. Although part of my point in my book was to kind of almost downplay this, but I didn't want to downplay this because when you see the evidence, you'll say, yeah, well, here it is. It's right there. They're talking about, you know, they're using some of that ideological trope. What does it actually mean? And so I try to go beyond that. I try to go into their psychology. And that's where the volume of materials actually makes such a great difference, because when you hear people like Khrushchev or Brezhnev talk about the same issues again and again and again. And you mentioned, Eric, you mentioned history. It's remarkable for me. Well, like, for example, Khrushchev and Brezhnev, they both talked about history in the conversations that they had. So they would give you a vision of history, their idea of history, and you hear them tell the same stories again and again and again. They come across as just regular people in some ways, and in other ways, highly irregular. But you start to understand them at a psychological level, and understanding their psychology for me became almost more important than understanding their quote-unquote ideology.
So just on that, the thing I found myself wondering is, I think the way you laid out makes sense, that they're, you know, your basic worldview, all of us, is to some extent filtered through certain, let's call them ideological assumptions, but when you're actually in the thick of events, you don't necessarily reflect that. But one thought that I had was, you know, there's the Marxist side, which sort of class-based economic determinism and all that. And then there's the Leninist side, which is really more kind of how you operate in the world and what kind of tools you think you can use to influence other states and when you want non-state actors. And it seems to me the Leninist side is certainly there. That is to say, you know, the kind of relentless opportunism that I think Lenin was in favor of the willingness to be quite brutal when that seems to be to your advantage, the pragmatism to pull back when the proverbial bayonet hits the proverbial steel rather than mush. So I wonder if that's one way of kind of resolving that. I'd like your thoughts on that. But there's another thought to go back to the conversation about legitimacy. For a number of reasons, I've been reading more 19th century Russian history, including Russian intellectual history. And I'm struck that that ambivalent attitude towards the West, both rejecting it at one level, but wanting its approval or its legitimacy, that's very Russian. I mean, that's, you know, set aside the Soviets. You can see it even in Nicholas I. And that leads to a broader question about the book, which is, to what extent would we be better off if we really interpreted Soviet behavior in the Cold War through the framework of Russian worldviews and the Russian drive for empire? A number of times you reference that, and actually particularly towards the end of the book, I think as you're interpreting the world that we're in now. Does that make sense to you, or how would you frame it or qualify it?
I mean, Elliot, I would agree with both of the takes that you've presented here. First of all, the opportunistic side of Soviet and Russian foreign policy. You know, obviously, Kennan had written about it as well in his long telegram. Was he thinking about Lenin? Was he thinking about some longer trends of Russian history? It's very difficult to say. I mean, I find opportunism clearly present in Russian foreign policy today, as it was present in Stalin's foreign policy when Kennan was writing his long telegram, as it was also present in Tsarist foreign policy. Is that a Leninist trait to be opportunistic? I'm not sure, but Lenin himself was certainly highly opportunistic. So he could have put his name to this. You know, we can call it Leninism instead of just opportunism, but I prefer opportunism because it creates, you know, it's a wider term. And obviously, I also apply some of the same insights towards my analysis of Chinese foreign policy behavior as well. No, that you can also call Leninist. As regards the second point about finding roots for China, for Russian foreign policy in the 19th century or even earlier, I think that's a very valid perspective. And if I argue that we find some parallels between how Putin is acting today and how the Soviets acted, then all the more do we find parallels between the way how the Soviets acted and how the Tsars acted in their imperialism and their striving for recognition. That's, by the way, very interesting. What was the Russian Empire? You know, the British Empire was a highly commercial enterprise. In many ways, it was a way of making money. It didn't always work this way, but certainly if you think about trade with China, et cetera, it was a commercial undertaking. The Russians annexed territory. They went into, you know, they pushed east, they pushed further east. Was that a commercial proposition for them? I don't think so. I think for the Russians, it was a lot of the times it was based on security or their insecurity. They feared for their frontiers in the east, as Kennan and others would have rightly remarked. But it was also about glory. It was about imperial glory, and it was being, you know, proper European imperial power. Oh, those other imperial powers, they have their empires, will also have our empire. Why do we need an empire? Because that's what great powers do. So I think that is very that in itself is very interesting. So this imperial thinking was certainly there, and it connects to Soviet thinking, and that is why Eric started our conversation by referring to Soviet post-war planning, and I was looking at all those files that were prepared by Litvinov, by Maisky, by others. I mean, one of the things that struck me in reading those things is just how imperialistic they were, how this whole idea, you know, the Soviets had this idea of dominating continental Europe, as far as Sweden even. They thought that Sweden would become a Soviet puppet, or, you know, they thought about controlling Turkey. They thought about basically dominating in Eastern Europe, and all of that. And what struck me especially was all of that was written by who? By the Anglophile or American, by Litvinov, Maxim Litvinov, who had what? FDR's picture on his desk, as they claim, right? This is the guy who was supposed to be the good guy, you know, not like Stalin, the bad guy, but he was thinking in very much Tsarist imperialist terms. So there's a lot of continuity. And I think one of the points of the book is to highlight this continuity, to say, yes, of course, the Soviet experience represented something different in some ways. And I talk towards the end of the book, especially why it failed. I mean, the whole system, the economic system was bonkers. It just wasn't working. But in terms of their ambition, in terms of their perception, their standing in the world, there is a lot of continuity between the Tsars, and then through Stalin and the Soviets, and all the way to Putin.
There's another theme that I think kind of courses through the book. It's a, you know, something that you refer back to again and again, and that is the tension that existed for Soviet leaders between being the head of state or head of government of a state that was both a status quo power, but also the head of a international revolutionary movement. And so it was both a revolutionary and a status quo power at the same time, which of course does violence to most of, you know, IR notions of how the world actually works. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that tension that Soviet leaders had to balance, and how well you think some, as opposed to others, did in balancing the two heads, if you will. If it was a czarist imperial eagle and had two heads, one was as a status quo power, one was as revolutionary power.
And Eric, this is a great question, because you drive here into kind of one of the central contentions of the book and some of the central contradictions, not just of the book, but also of Soviet foreign policy. By the way, this is where ideology comes back through the back door, because we cannot talk about being recognized as the leader of the revolutionary world without any, you know, reference to what revolution actually meant. And of course, Marxism-Leninism comes in there. And that's why I don't, you know, I like to say that actually I'm not trying to debunk ideology in the book. I just say that it's more complicated than just saying that it's ideology and nothing else. It actually does a great disservice to our understanding of the complexities of Soviet foreign policy. But the central point is this, that the Soviets wanted to be recognized on the one hand by the Americans as a co-equal superpower. And on the other hand, they also wanted to be recognized by quote-unquote revolutionary world as the leaders of the revolutionary world. Now, when I say revolutionary world, what I really mean is China. And that's actually one of the big arguments of the book. In almost every aspect of Soviet foreign policy, they looked over their shoulder just to see how the Chinese reacted to this. And this was both during the time when they had a very close relationship, i.e. in the 1950s, and especially when this relationship started to fall apart towards the end of the 1950s and into the 1960s, because at that point, Khrushchev was just constantly worried about how will the Chinese react to whatever I'm doing? Will they try then to undermine my legitimacy by claiming that I'm betraying revolution? And that became extremely important during the Cuban Missile Crisis and in the aftermath. I mean, we just focus on the few days in October, generally speaking, in the historiography. But for Khrushchev, the issue of Cuba was much longer. It was much bigger, because this question of Cuba engaged Soviet interests as a revolutionary and Soviet credibility as a revolutionary power. The Chinese were constantly trying to undermine their prestige there. There was a competition between the two. So basically, I argue that the Soviets were trying to get recognition from both the Americans as a great power and then also from the revolutionary world. But there was a contradiction between these two types of recognition, because the Americans, especially under Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger, as we know, were pushing for, they were basically arguing, if you want a good relationship, if you want a productive relationship between our two countries, then please do not export revolution to the what was then called the Third World, now we call it the Global South. And the Soviets, at one level, yes, they wanted to run the world together with the United States. That, by the way, that quote, this comes from Brezhnev, of course, talking to Kissinger in 1973, where he basically took him to this hunting tower close to Moscow. They were hunting for hunting boars, and then he said to him, according to Kissinger's later comment, that, you know, we just want to run the world together with you. But at the same time, the Soviets could not quite give up this other ambition of being recognized as the leaders of the revolutionary world. And the way they squared it in their mind was, if we are recognized by the Americans as a great power, why is it that we cannot export revolution? I mean, the Americans export counter-revolution, so we are an equal power, therefore we're allowed to export revolution, and we're allowed to have our clients, because any great power is supposed to have its clients. So in their mind, the linkage thing, you know, was never supposed to, it didn't make any sense at all. And they reconciled the two facets of recognition and tried to run with the hounds and with the hares at the same time. But this is what made detente particularly fragile, because you cannot actually run with hares and hounds at the same time. You have to choose sides, basically. And they never quite reconcile themselves to this necessity.
I mean, to use a Marxist-Leninist term, it's the internal contradictions that seem to get them. And you really developed that, I think, quite well. Actually, I thought one of the other things that's interesting is, of course, you know, you have the Chinese and the Soviets competing for leadership of the revolutionary world. And then all of a sudden, the Chinese find, you know, Vietnamese don't actually acknowledge them as the leaders, and you know they're everybody's kind of caught in that trap. Could I ask a somewhat different kind of question? So, the account that you give us is very much centered on key leaders, on, you know, Stalin, Brezhnev, Khrushchev, Gorbachev. And it's much less on what some British historians call the official mind, you know, how the bureaucracy thinks about things, about common viewpoints. So could you just walk us through that? Is that because, A, basically there was sort of unanimity or kind of a common worldview among all of the Soviet leadership and the bureaucracies that support them? Is that because this was a... even under Khrushchev and Brezhnev, a highly personalistic regime. So it really mattered enormously what Mr. Big thought was the right answer. Just, you know, could you talk to us about that?
So I thank you, Elliot. This is a great question. I think it really depends on the leader that we're talking about here. So Stalin did indeed exercise a gigantic influence on policymaking. We can see that. Eric already referred to how he controlled Molotov at the London Conference of Foreign Ministers, literally, you know, sending cables on a daily basis. And you read them and you understand how, you know, Molotov had no space for maneuver. He just had to do what the boss says, basically. So that completely defined Soviet foreign policy, just what Stalin thought effectively. With Khrushchev, also a lot of the times he really pushed his preferences, and you rarely see other people making their voice heard. Among those who could was Mikoyan, Anastas Mikoyan. He was second in command, and he occasionally contradicted Khrushchev. Like, for example, he didn't think that it was a particularly good idea to send missiles to Cuba. The really interesting case, though, is Brezhnev, because Brezhnev, we think of Brezhnev as being basically quite senile, etc. But early on, in his early few years, he became general secretary, first secretary in 1964. And until approximately, for the first 10 years, until approximately 1974, he was actually very charismatic and tried to define policy. And we can see this in his single-minded pursuit of detente with Richard Nixon. He valued this relationship despite the fact that there was bureaucratic backlash against this, and there were some people in the leadership who were saying, you know, why are we doing this? This is not a good idea. But he thought that, you know, he could really deal with Nixon. He loved Nixon. It was very interesting, you know, just admired Nixon and just could not reconcile himself to Watergate. You know, he could could not believe that America could allow itself to be dragged down by something ridiculous like Watergate. And one of the funny anecdotes I tell in the book is how at one point the KGB were trying to figure out, one of the Brezhnev's aides were asking, you know, can we help Nixon? Is there compromise on his enemies that we can actually, you know, and Andropov, the head of the KGB, wrote something like, well, we have limited opportunities. Maybe we can try to do something. Obviously, like, in the end, they could not do anything about it. But then Brezhnev suffered a mental breakdown. And he never quite recovered from it. It happened late in 1974, and he developed a medical condition. He used sleeping pills, and then he became the sort of person that we kind of know him as, very, very kind of almost senile, not very effective, unable to really conduct policy, more of a, almost like a mummy that they rolled out on occasion to greet foreign visitors, but not really in control of policy. And that is very interesting because it is at that time that you have competing bureaucratic interests that are really pushing different foreign policies. You have the foreign ministry, for example, under Andrei Gromyko, who were interested in detente with the West and were worried about promotion of revolution in the Third World, et cetera, because that actually undermined those goals. You have the military, who basically wanted bases and more investment in the military, and they also exercised a lot of influence, increasing influence as we move into the late 1970s. Then you had also the International Department, and folks there basically just knew about how to promote communist revolutions in the Third World, and that's what they did. And so when you had Brezhnev, who was capable, he could actually reconcile some of his views and dismiss some that he did not like and pursue policies that he liked, i.e. detente. When you have Brezhnev in decline, this actually, you know, whole Soviet foreign policy scene is overtaken by competing interests. And then there's almost a stagnation and a sense of, you know, where are we going? Are we going anywhere at all? And then as a result, the Soviet Union gets bogged down in this crazy adventures or misadventures like in Afghanistan. You know, would a sane Brezhnev actually approved the invasion of Czechoslovakia in 1968? So that doesn't guarantee anything. But when you get to Brezhnev in 1979, you know, he's basically just endorsing whatever is put in front of his nose, and he endorsed the invasion of Afghanistan. The Soviets were stuck there for 10 years. They realized almost immediately that it was a mistake. So, you know, how would it be possible would it be different with a different leader? Maybe. So that just shows that absent leadership, you have bureaucratic interests that take over.
There's so many things we can delve into here, Sergei, because the book is so rich. You were talking earlier when you were talking about the tensions between being a revolutionary power and a status quo power about the rivalry with China. And that is, I think, one of the richest parts of the book because of your access, as you mentioned earlier, to Eliot in the conversation, to Chinese archival materials as well as Russian. And so you're getting kind of the stereophonic story of this very complex, you know, relationship that you describe that seems to have on both sides sort of a approach avoidance, you know, kind of issues. Both sides kind of want to have the relationship on a healthy basis, but neither side can quite figure out, you know, whether they're in charge or the other is in charge. And there's clearly rivalry and jealousy of all sorts, personal as well as ideological and political. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, because you also, I think, very effectively show how on many occasions Russian policy is in fact reflecting this rivalry for leadership in the communist world. And certain, you were talking earlier about leaders make a difference and the contingency of events. In many, many occasions that you describe, it seems that Khrushchev or Brezhnev were making decisions on the basis of like, what are the Chinese going to do here? And how is that going to impact this larger relationship and our larger role in the communist world?
Well, yes. I mean, Eric, as I mentioned, China is huge as far as Soviet thinking about foreign policy is concerned. That should not surprise us, of course, because it was a major ally in the 50s and then became a major enemy. In fact, by 1969, the Soviet Union and China were on the verge of war. In fact, they were fighting a war in the vicinity of Zhangbao Dao or Damansky island, and the Soviets were already dropping hints of a nuclear strike against China. So, of course, that had to have some kind of impact on Soviet thinking. Well, I discovered this impact in all kinds of situations. I already mentioned the Cuban Missile Crisis and how the idea, you know, for Khrushchev was so important. I mean, we always thought about in the West, in the traditional thinking about the Cuban Missile Crisis, to think about how for Khrushchev the idea was to kind of, you know, place strategic missiles on Cuba so as to threaten the United States. And there's something to it. And of course, you know, a lot of these explanations are multi-causal. But what I also found was that Khrushchev was definitely, he was concerned about losing Cuba to the United States, to a possible American invasion. Why was he so concerned about it? Because he thought that the Chinese would blame him for basically losing a key ally. And that would really undermine his legitimacy in the quote-unquote revolutionary world. He really cared about this. Here's another interesting aspect where China played into Soviet strategic thinking. In the late 1960s, we have basically Brezhnev pursued detente first with the European powers, with France, with Germany, Willy Brandt, with West Germany, of course, you know, with his Ostpolitik, and then ultimately with Richard Nixon in the early 1970s. China was a huge factor there. And there is where you have the civilizational view by Brezhnev that China represented a threat to the future of Europe, or you broadly understood, and he included the United States as part of the European civilization. So you almost have this Huntington-like thesis, you know, there's a clash of civilization, you know, the Europeans should stick together. And so he has, you know, he's reaching out to Nixon saying, look, don't trust the Chinese, you know, let's work together to basically constrain their ambitions. So it's there all the time. They're looking over their shoulder. And what I found really interesting, that, well, I think it enlivens the book as well, is that in the 1950s in particular, Nikita Khrushchev, of course, met with Mao Zedong, and those meetings provided some of the craziest encounters of the Cold War, where they discussed the future of the West, where, you know, how to react to the United States, you know, how you deal with the nuclear question on the Cold War, etc. My favorite anecdote, of course, which I talk about in the book, is 1958, Nikita Khrushchev and Mao Zedong meet inside the swimming pool in Zhongnanhai. Now we have records of both on both the Chinese record and the Russian record of this meeting. We have four meetings and, you know, two records of them, so we can really reproduce this whole atmosphere in intricate detail. And what struck me was Mao Zedong and Khrushchev kind of boasting about the future of communism and how, oh, we're defeating the Americans, and soon we will blow up the United Nations, and we will set up a new United Nations on an island on the sea, and we will build communism, and all the toilets will be made out of gold. And, you know, you read something like that, you think, what do you make of it? You know, how does it even make any sense? But anyway, so I put a lot of this stuff in the book, and I found it made, maybe it actually added to the length of the book, but I hope readers will find it interesting, at least.
You also have there's a great story of, I don't know, is it McCoyan or somebody comes back from China, you know, they've given him tofu and, you know, various Chinese spices, and of course they immediately have it tested. It's got salmonella in it. They're afraid the spices will kill them. But actually, on this point, maybe we can make it a little bit contemporary. I mean, I was very struck by the your depiction of Brezhnev's self-identification as European, the Chinese as the sort of the Asian other. And I've got two questions which, you know, I then want to take into the present, given your particularly interesting background and experiences, which is, first, was Brezhnev unusual in this regard? I mean, again, my sense from reading Russian history is that, you know, Russians have sort of thought of themselves as kind of European, but also different, but certainly not Asian in quite the same in that way. And, you know, we're now in a world where, at least for a time, Putin does seem to have thrown his lot in to some extent with China, except this time with Russia as the subordinate partner, which has to be galling to at least, you know, large chunks of the bureaucracy. You know, help us think that through. You know, I think one of the things that a fine historian like yourself can help one do is say, look, there's something here that's just not going to last because this is unnatural. Or would that be a mistake? I mean, should we not count on that?
So on the question of Brezhnev's identity, I mean, first of all, identity clearly mattered. And I don't know what that makes me, something of a constructivist when it comes to, am I a realist or a constructivist? I don't know. There's a whole IR theory behind it. Oh, forget about the term. But anyway, identity clearly mattered to him. And this whole idea about him being European, I mean, that is also interesting. But also it's true of other Soviet leaders. Now, what you refer to in your remarks is the long-standing debate among Russian intellectuals going back to the 19th century, really, about what Russia actually is. Is Russia part of Europe, or is it a civilization of its own? I don't think anybody at that, even in the 19th century, certainly not even today, sees Russia as an Asian country. I don't think that is a thing. But there's a long-standing debate as to whether it's actually part of Europe or whether it's a thing by itself. And today, I think the pendulum went the other way. And now, certainly in the Russian strategic discussion, Russia is presented as being its own thing and different from Europe. But I don't know how fundamentally, culturally, how well-founded this idea is. And you can see in Brezhnev clearly that he thought that Russia actually was a European Soviet Union, was a European civilization. We see some of the same themes, certainly in Khrushchev, but especially in Gorbachev. And when we get to Gorbachev, Gorbachev was clearly thinking about the Soviet civilization being part of the European civilization. And, that's why he brings this whole concept of a common European home, that we're all part of Europe, et cetera, et cetera. And that's why the Cold War is actually relevant. Let's try something else. So that's how it all ends, right? So that is really interesting. Now, with regard to the second part of your question of Putin's turn towards China, I think there's something interesting here from both sides. I mean, both the Russians and the Chinese recognize that they had a period recently in their history, relatively recently, when actually both Putin and Xi Jinping are of the age that they can remember that, a long confrontation between China and the Soviet Union, a bitter confrontation with a lot of hatred and a lot of militarization along the border. And if there's a lesson that they carried away from this, it is that this is a situation to be avoided because this can be used by third parties against them. So, when we talk about Kissinger and Nixon kind of using this situation, the situation arose and then it was there for Kissinger and Nixon to use it, right? So it's slightly different today when sometimes people talking about doing a Kissinger or repeating Kissinger's feat. It's much more difficult today because they have a close relationship. Why is it that they have a close relationship? They understand that conflict does not actually, it's kind of, they had conflict and it was used against them, and it's best for them to avoid it to the extent that they can. And actually, the interesting thing here has been the Chinese sensitivity to Russia's concerns, more or less, so far, and I'm saying so far with an emphasis on so far, because if at one point Xi Jinping cracks the whip and says, you do what we want you to do, then this is going to be a very interesting moment to watch how the Russians will react. But so far, he's kind of been deferring to Putin, saying, okay, yeah, we're in the same boat, we're working towards the same goal. But, Elliot, to come back to this other question that you had and the point that you made about, are the Russians happy about being effectively the second fiddle or a junior partner and so on and so forth? My sense is no, they're not happy about this. So yes, of course, Putin got himself into the situation. Now they have to make the best out of this, and they're claiming, oh yeah, this is great. But look what happened just a few days ago. Narendra Modi came to Moscow. They rolled out the red carpet for him. They gave him a golden chain. Our great friend, the Indian prime minister, and so on and so forth. And obviously, it was a horrible thing for Modi to do while Russia is bombing the hell out of Ukraine to go to Moscow and to be honored and, receive a golden chain from Putin.
On the eve of the NATO summit.
It was terrible. It was obviously, tone deaf for Modi to do that. But But what this shows from the Russian perspective, they wanted to do it. It's not just a signal to the West. It's especially a signal to China. Ah, you think we're a junior partner? Ah, we'll have Modi here. And let's see who's the junior partner now. But I think a lot of the Russian elite, the strategic circles, and of course, they're not comfortable with being effectively under the Chinese thumb. And they're looking for an opportunity to escape from that because, of course, for them, it's important to be recognized as a great power on their own and not somebody who's just basically a sidekick to the Chinese.
Yeah, a vassal state. Sergei, we could go on for hours, literally, and unfortunately, we're running out of time. So I wanted to, uncharacteristically, I'm going to take the last word and ask a final question, which is, in this entire kind of 600-page relook at the Cold War that you do, as we've said throughout this conversation, a lot of emphasis on contingency, a lot of emphasis on the psychology of individual leaders and how it played out. You know, the historiography, of course, traditionally in the United States said, you know, Soviet Union was, you know, responsible for the Cold War. It was aggressive Soviet policies in Poland in particular, and then in the rest of Eastern and Central Europe that led to the Cold War. I was taught by revisionist foreign policy historians from the Wisconsin School who said, no, it really was the U.S., you know, not taking into account legitimate Soviet security interests in Europe that led to the Cold War. Arthur Schlesinger, famously in an essay in Foreign Affairs, said that the Cold War was inevitable because Stalin's paranoia was such that there was no reasonable accommodation with him. After all of your work in both the Russian and the Chinese archives, where do you come down? What is your, you know, ultimate judgment on wherein lies responsibility for the Cold War that overtook the global the global system from 1948 on to 1991?
So, Eric, this is obviously very, very complicated question. I would say in this debate, the great debate between the traditionalists and the revisionists, I'm more on the traditionalist side, and I see Stalin as largely responsible for the Cold War because he had the ambition to rule in Europe. And that is very clear. It comes out in the documents. Yes, he was opportunistic. Yes, he pulled back in many instances, actually was beaten back and, you know, retreated in various diplomatic games that he played, like in Iran, for example, in 1946, etc. So there were kind of, you know, instances where he did not get what he wanted, but he wanted stuff. Yeah, he wanted, you talked about legitimate interests, legitimate in whose eyes, you know, legitimate in the eyes of the people who were conquered by the Soviets and had to live under Stalin's boot. I don't think so. So that, you know, it comes back to this question of Stalin's ambition. And now, some historians, of course, actually reasonably say that Stalin did not, he was actually had limited gains. He was looking for great power cooperation, division of the world into spheres of influence in accordance with Yalta. Putin recently has resurrected the image of Yalta. He's been talking about Yalta. You know, just recognize our legitimate interests. We don't have anything, you know, we don't have any greater gains. So people have been talking that, historians have been highlighting this, that Stalin had limited aims in the post-war period, and that he wanted great power cooperation, and that the Cold War kind of arose because of the American pushback against, you know, some of the sphere that he perceived fell into his, you know, or some of the, you know, some of the parts that he thought were in his sphere of interest, but, or his sphere of influence. But here's the problem. The problem is the Americans push back against what they perceived Stalin's aggressive intent. We don't know if the Americans did not contain Stalin's ambitions. We do not know that Stalin would have actually stayed within the parameters of those ambitions. It's like the French say, the appetite comes during eating. He may not even himself realize that he wanted to get something else, but if he was allowed to get it, he would perhaps take the next step. And why not, if he had the opportunity to do so? That is why this is the tragedy, ultimately, right, of the Cold War, because you might say that actually America pushing back on some of the Stalin's ambitions created a security dilemma, ultimately contributed to the outbreak of the Cold War. But the price for getting it wrong and for not pushing back and therefore allowing Stalin to expand would have been Soviet domination of Europe. The price that we ultimately got was just the Cold War.
Well, that will have to do it for this episode of Shield of the Republic. I want to thank you, Sergei. Our guest has been Sergei Radchenko. The book is To Run the World, The Kremlin's Cold War Bid for Global Power. I highly recommend it to our listeners and viewers. If you want to get a deep sense of the wellsprings of what has created the war in Ukraine, this is the place to get it. Sergei, thank you so much for being with us.
Sergei, that was terrific. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. Thank you, Elliot. Thank you, Eric, for having me on. I really appreciate it. And I hope I made sense.
You were terrific.
I had a few glasses of wine here. there's some kind of thing. I wasn't sure whether it would make any sense.
given the subject matter, adult beverages are definitely encouraged on this program. And speaking of which, Elliot and I will be back next week. As this is recorded, we're still taking in the events of the weekend and the horrific assassination attempt against former President Trump, and what the potential consequences of the Trump-Vance Republican ticket will be. Elliot and I will be back to talk about that next week. We look forward to seeing our viewers and our listeners hearing our considered views of that at that time.
You don't need to be ripped. You just need the right shirt. Epic Fits gives you a clean, confident silhouette. Snug on the arms, soft on the skin, generous where it counts. And with deals like $15 per tee, they won't break the bank. Visit epicfits.com today. Epic Fits. T-shirts that get it.